addition to Persian.
کسی نیامد به قطران بگوید شما در تعویض شما بیا شعر فارسی.
Nobody demanded Qatran to write Farsi poems. No one asked the poet in Shiraz to write in Farsi. They all chose to do that themselves. The Farsi that took shape 1100 years ago underwent an evolution throughout the centuries that passed. Which version of Farsi are we feeling proud of? The Farsi that Hafez, Nizami and Rumi, who went from Balkh to Konya, wrote their poems in. That's the Farsi we're proud of and rely on. No government ordered Rumi to write poems in Farsi. This is a rug, each knot of which belongs to a specific region. The more knots there are in the rug, the more durable it will be.
Chapter 3, Article 19 says, All people of Iran, whatever the ethnic group or tribe to which they belong, enjoy equal rights, and color, race, language, and the like do not bestow any privilege.
خودم گیلانی هستم. حالا این
I'm from Gilan. I was born to a Taleshi family and my mother tongue is Taleshi. My family migrated to Rasht and started speaking to me in Gilaki when I was born. I acquired Gilaki at home, learned Farsi at school and learned to speak Taleshi at the same time. What sparked my interest in the Farsi language, which I've studied as a major and I'm speaking right now, was the fascination I had in Shahriyar's poetry back in my student years. If I didn't know Shahriyar, maybe I would have pursued a different educational and occupational path.
Talking of the unifying element of Persian, this language that has given Iranians a wealth of literature and science to boast, and which all touched by it love it and won't give it up, Dariush Shayegan, an Iranian scholar, puzzled when in Egypt as to why Egyptians, themselves an ancient civilization, would take on Arabic as their state language. Hassanein Heykal, an Egyptian journalist, explained, because we didn't have a Ferdowsi, meaning we didn't have a poet that great to write a divan using a minimum of Arabic and a maximum of our own words to rescue and preserve our language and mythology. Because that is what the great Ferdowsi did for Iran and Iranians of any creed and color.
The BBC Persian made a program and invited someone for an interview as a linguistic expert. The first question the host asked the expert was, what sufferings have you had to experience throughout the years because of Farsi? We have had over 200,000 Farsi dialects in the country. The people have lived with each other for centuries and have never had a problem with their languages. The question the BBC Persian host posed and the answer the expert gave laid the foundation for the other issues. After that, Al Arabiya Farsi, which is a part of Saudi Arabia's security agencies, asked the viewers, what problems do you have with Farsi? It is interesting to know that the BBC Persian expert is an agent managed and controlled by Germany's Federal Intelligence Service. His ties with Western intelligence services in Europe and the cooperation between them and Saudi and Arab services to affect the people in our society are the manifestation of the hybrid warfare we are currently witnessing.
See, the Azeris, that's people from eastern and western Azerbaijan provinces, call Tehran Central Azerbaijan. I need not explain their prominent presence in the capital. Here are some examples of ethnicities, all ethnicities, if you can call all of them ethnicities, who have been of position in the state's power parities.
I think they were gauging the public reaction. It's the nature of media work. You're doing this yourself. We have a day called the International Mother Language Day and create appropriate events to mark it. It falls on the 2nd of Isfand or the 21st of February. The fact that they focused on the issue 3 to 4 weeks prior to the day in their media can signal that they were after bigger plans and were just testing the waters. The results they saw wasn't what they expected. The educated people living in Azerbaijan, even those who write poems in their local language, those in Gilan and others, didn't give them the results they wanted. What the Iranians told them was kind of a slap in their face. I believe that they canceled their other plans because of that.
The first evidence of Persian literature is generally dated to 522 BCE with the creation of the Behistun inscription of Darius I. New or modern Persian, however, the form written since the 9th century, is known as Farsi in Iran, where it is the country's official language, and as Dari in Afghanistan, where it and Pashto are official languages. It is written in a Cyrillic alphabet by Tajiks in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. New Persian, that's the Persian we've been speaking about, has for centuries been a prestigious cultural language in Western Central Asia, on the Indian subcontinent, and in Turkey.
What all Europeans stand for is to remove the barriers and have single identity cards and means of communication so they can invest anywhere in Europe and become more united. They want Iran to be divided, and yet they themselves move towards unity. But you can already invest anywhere in Iran and live anywhere across the country. We have it all in here. Now imagine Iran has been divided into five separate regions. What we want is to have them united the way Europe is trying to. They wanted to establish a common language, but failed. Over there in Europe, every country, be it Germany, France, Italy, or Norway, has its own language. But over here, our common language is Farsi, but all other languages are of equal value.
In the past, Persian was widely understood in an area ranging from the Middle East or West Asia to Central and South Asia, even to Xinjiang in China. Persian is the second language of Islam. It was instrumental in spreading the faith during the reign of the Mughals in the Indian subcontinent. There are many Persian words to be found in Urdu and Turkish, and the study of Ottoman Turkish literature actually would be meaningless without knowledge of Persian. Never mind the Persian language, the Turks are pretty cut off from their past because they changed their script. There are sizable Persian language or dialect-speaking populations in other West Asian countries as well, such as Bahrain, Iraq, Oman, Yemen, and the UAE. Large communities in Europe, Turkey, Australia, the USA and Canada also speak standard Persian.
I think you can find the most beautiful words in Farsi in the poems of Ferdowsi, Hafez and Saadi. Our language has been so rich that you can see its impressions on the works of Goethe and Western writers. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons the British focused on Farsi and launched such psychological warfare was because of the same reasons. They wanted to toot the English language and culture as superior. But if they have Shakespeare, we have Hafez, Saadi and Rumi. We have a cultural and civilizational hub, something they are against.
That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
There are specific criteria for being a revolutionary. In the Holy Quran, this commitment to values has been referred to as steadfastness. Another example is, as for those who say, our Lord is Allah, then stand straight and steadfast. The angels descend upon them, saying, fear not, nor be grieved, and receive good news of the garden which you were promised. Chapter 41, verse 30. In the Holy Quran, this commitment to the principles and values is referred to as steadfastness. The second criterion is making great efforts to attain our ideals and refusing to abandon these ideas and lofty goals. The opposite of this is laziness, obscurantism, and hopelessness. Some people try to discourage society and our youth by saying, it is of no use. It cannot be done. We will not reach there. And how can we do so with all these oppositions and enmity? This is the opposite of the second criterion.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second criterion is that we never change our attitude about attaining lofty goals and ideas, and we do not give up in the face of pressure. Of course, when you are taking a path on which there are enmities, they create obstacles for you, but this should not prevent you from moving forward and from continuing the path. We should not give in to pressures, and we should not be satisfied with the status quo. Because if we are satisfied with the status quo, the result will be backwardness. I have repeated many times that the youth should keep moving towards progress and positive change. If we become satisfied with what we already have, for example, imagine that we have made certain achievements in a scientific area which are accepted by the entire world. The whole world agrees that we have made progress in that area. We will remain backward, and we will move further backward. The path to progress is endless. We should keep moving until we reach lofty ideals. As I said, the third criterion is a commitment to independence. Independence is very important. It includes domestic, regional, global, and international independence.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Despite COVID-19 and the hyped-up coverage of the pandemic by U.S. mainstream media, main cause of hospital and rehab admissions remains excessive consumption of alcohol, usually by adults, while the younger generation finds itself facing novel chemical drugs in the black market. Therefore, overdosing on dangerous drugs persists, and Americans continue living with a very serious drug problem. Destructive aspects of drugs available in American drug market has exacerbated today. Fentanyl, for example, is similar to morphine, although it is reportedly 50 to 100 times more potent. That offers another relative explanation for the rise in the number of overdose deaths.
And I just realized that maybe I'll give sobriety a shot, because the worst thing that could ever happen is maybe I'll be happy. Worst thing that could happen if I keep going is I'll die.
U.S. Hidden Epidemic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. In this episode, we will delve into all the aspects of a much less reported epidemic in America, drug overdose. In today's show, I'll be accompanied by activist and commentator Stephen Young out of Lake City, New Jersey. And later in the program, we'll be joined by social justice activist and podcast host Cindy Sheehan from Vacaville, California. Together, we'll try to find out how much the drug overdose epidemic has changed in the U.S., who's the most impacted, and more importantly, what could be done about it by the government, the states, and the people. Stay tuned.
I can tell you that in the height of my addiction, my little brother overdosed. And when I say overdose, I mean me and him shot heroin together. And I realized he wasn't breathing. His lips started turning blue.
A determining factor in the spiking overdose deaths is the opioid crisis, which has been tearing the families and communities in the United States for a couple of years now. The crisis began by overprescription of drugs such as OxyContin to average Americans seeking treatment for health problems like chronic headaches. The move had been promoted by the big pharma in companies such as Purdue Pharma.
Now, while the company was brought down in courts, the powerful Sackler family has managed to escape all accountability. The Sackler family still stands accused, though, of helping fuel the U.S. opioid epidemic. How much are powerful entities such as the Sackler family to blame for skyrocketing addictions and overdoses in America?
I want to blame the Sackler family almost completely for this, but they also had a lot of help. The Sackler family had a lot of deep ties to the FDA and local law enforcement. And so the Sackler family wanted to make a lot of money. They developed this so-called time-release painkiller that was, they got the FDA to do something unprecedented. They put it on the label that it was non-addictive. And a lot of the doctors that they were, and then they used aggressive marketing techniques where the sales representatives for Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the Sackler family's pharmaceutical company, were taught how to lie to people, how to lie to the doctors. And they told doctors that it was not addictive. And the doctors are like, well, I never heard of an opioid that wasn't addictive. And at that time, there was a crisis in painkillers, people getting addicted to painkillers.
opioid overdoses are specifically tragic as they're affecting people who are less prone to addiction. They just happen to refer to their doctor for mostly normal and benign health issues. It is therefore safe to say that they are victims of the medical industrial complex in the US, which has been obsessed with reaping benefits from the pharmaceutical industries with no regard for its repercussions.
It is really tragic. You know, we've seen cases in our own community. The people who get addicted to these painkillers, eventually their source dries up. And when my sister, for example, was suffering from cancer, and she couldn't get painkillers for her cancer pain, which was real.
And now Americans are facing a very serious crisis, which emanated from the complex internal politics of the healthcare juggernaut, where men on top make decisions about how to lead the sector in order to gain the most profits for themselves. So how could rising numbers of overdoses in the United States affect the current existing public health crisis?
Well, you know, the opiate epidemic has a lot to do with prescription drugs. And that's very key to drugs, period. Right now, a lot of young people have been taking drugs. So it definitely will affect, you know, people being able to function and work and provide for their families. Drug addiction in this country is it's almost like heroin, use of heroin. You know, heroin was the epidemic was very dangerous because people did anything to just get a needle in their arm. And these days they're doing anything to get a pill right now, even when it comes to they selling their family if they have to. So this is very important, and they're hurting a lot of elders because they go to their parents and ask for so much money over and over again just to continue to get the drug.
To this day, families in America have had to pay the price for what Big Pharma has done. Overdoses also occur on the more powerful synthetic opioids such as fentanyl and meth, which are smuggled into America or made illegally inside the country. The response to the epidemic by the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has been deemed inadequate.
I think that it's tragic that almost everybody in the United States, including my family, including not a family member, but a close person that might as well have been a family member, have died from overdoses. Our friend, as a matter of fact, died from fentanyl overdose. But the president's son, you know, heroin and crack. And so it's this widespread problem.
The U.S. residents' budget request for the fiscal year 2022 calls for a $41 billion investment on national drug program agencies. The budget request offers a nearly $670 million increase over the one last year, and the administration claims that it will be spent on evidence-based prevention, treatment, harm reduction, and recovery support services.
Well, one thing they can start with, like I was speaking about, you know, the people that has experienced the most has been dealing the drugs as well as using the drug. They have more experience than the doctors that have degrees. They have more experience than the people that went to school and colleges and university to learn about it and study about it. And that's all you have to do is ask the average person who's been using that drug for 15 years, 10 years, 5 years, or a year. And how their effect was, and you can start turning it around because they can tell you from their experience. One thing you cannot take away from anyone or give anybody is experience, and you cannot take that away from them. And that's priceless, and we need to start using that towards the solutions in this country.
It's still not clear whether the huge sums of money could effectively turn the tide of the overdose epidemic in America. However, the administration acknowledges that getting rid of the pandemic entails collaboration between federal, state, and local law enforcement, as well as public health officials. Generally speaking, how could the U.S. government's so-called war on drugs really be assessed?
Well, as you all know, when the United States declares war on anything, it gets worse. So there was a war on cancer. Cancer has grown exponentially in the United States. There's a war on terrorism, which, you know, didn't do anything to defeat terrorism, but in fact caused many people to rebel or to rise up against the United States because of the United States actions. And this war on drugs is the same thing. I believe Nancy Reagan was really influential in starting the war on drugs. And since the war on drugs began, it's only gotten worse. And we can really combine the war on terror with the war on drugs, because since the United States invaded Afghanistan, the opiate supply has been much larger.
Now, according to some statistics, U.S. has seen a 50% rise in the cases of overdoses compared to the 1990s. This is in line with a sharp spike in recent street crimes, gun violence, and a widening political rift across the nation. Just like the big oil and big tech, the U.S. government is failing to take on big pharma.
We don't have a national health care plan here in the United States. In fact, my state, California, just shot down another chance to have some kind of public health plan here. And the bottom line is that the United States is captured by big pharma. You know, big pharma pays hundreds of millions of dollars to influence the media. They sponsor almost all of the legacy media here in the United States.
Myriad corrupt politicians appear to be bound to solely bow to the demands of the formidable industry and act like puppets in the face of their intense quest for profit. How could such overdoses impact the victims' communities and families?
These drugs has been out here for years, but it wasn't until it started hitting the white community that they started doing something about it. When you had a lot of white people from overdoses, such as judges' children, and lawyers' children, and so forth, when they started dying from overdose and opioid and everything, all of a sudden it became a lot of rehabs for people, for everybody. They had to make it equal now, try to make it equal. They didn't make it equal, but they stopped a lot of things, such as a lot of arrest and how long they stay in jail, and started giving them rehab. Well, we have been asking for that for a long, long time.
Roughly 17,000 Americans died of an overdose in the year 2000, whereas the figure rose over 100,000 in 2021. The trend appears to be spiraling out of control, as a National Center for Health Statistics report showed in the last week of 2021.
Now, the shocking increase remains the largest year-over-year rate increase on record. And it's not difficult to assume the hidden epidemic has impacted certain portions of society harder, poor people, as well as communities of color like African Americans. So what should authorities do to address overdoses and generally the issue of addiction in America?
A lot of people come by their addictions because they got injured, right? They got injured at work. They got injured in a car accident. They got injured, however people get injured. And so they're prescribed these very addictive painkillers, which everybody was lied to, saying that they weren't addictive. And then what your body does is it creates pain so you can get the painkiller, right? And your body gets used to the dosage, so you have to take more and more and more and more.
Overdoses and other drug-related troubles keep inundating the more vulnerable portions of the society, and there seems to be no immediate remedy in sight. Consumption of drugs is targeted towards young children, who are most prized possessions of America. As more and more young kids die due to overdose, new adolescent arrivals are victimized by the legal and illegal drug industry.
Now, according to the 2020 National Survey on Drug Use and Health, 14.5% of Americans, that's roughly 40,300,000 people, had a substance abuse disorder in 2020. And the figure is at least expected to be lingering where it is, if not growing.
There are some serious things that we have solutions to, but are they working with the people that had the solutions? The solutions usually with the grassroots people, the foundation, the ones that's unheard, the ones that's not at the tables making these decisions. But like these young people hit the street with Black Lives Matter, they have solutions to a lot of things, but are they being listened to? I mean, I've been out here for over 30 to 40 years, you know, as a young man and getting older now. But have they listened to the solutions to being able to plan a city and create a home ownership and get rid of the poverty so we can have peace throughout the land? So as long as there's solutions, there should not be these problems in America.
Hard drugs are sold in the streets as traffickers are reportedly increasing the amount pouring into the country. It must not come as big shock that the overdoses have increased. A rise in the amount of hard drugs smuggled into the country simply signifies an increase for demand, which translates to a spike in overdose deaths.
Opioid crisis is one of the number one health issues in the United States. There's over 100,000 overdoses every year now. There's over $1 billion being spent on addressing addiction.
The hidden epidemic is indeed a grave national security and public health challenge for the United States and its officials. Overdoses are considered the cause of death for more people than car crashes, firearms, suicide, or homicide.
The FDA, the Sackler family, law enforcement who refused to prosecute the Sackler family or to even investigate the addiction, they're all involved in the crisis. And there were some people who really wanted this looked into, and they were stonewalled by the FDA, and it's just very interesting here in the United States.
The U.S. must rush to disrupt the flow of the illegal drugs into the country from overseas and crack down on middlemen as well as drug cartels sustaining the supply chain for the illicit substances.
America always had a war on a lot of things, mostly a war against Black people. They did a war on drugs, a war on gangs, but they do a war on everything but poverty, you know. So, you know, if you don't straighten out the poverty in this country, how are you going to, you know, cure the violence and have peace? And that's one issue that America spends and wastes a lot of millions and millions of dollars giving it to the same people, mainly to millionaires. In this country, it is called corporate welfare when they get tax breaks for coming into poor neighborhoods and make a profit.
Not all overdose cases lead to deaths, yet the instance could still cause suffering for the addicts themselves, as well as their families and friends, for quite a long time. Lasting impact of the experience adds to the burden of societal issues emanating from addiction in general.
And we must stop using people as an experiment with these type of drugs as well. COVID-19 is shut down the entire world because nobody knew the cure. No one knew where it came from. How can that be when, again, you can go to the moon, but you can't figure out what happens right here on this earth?
And now we're going to check in with Abbas Motarim. He's going to speak about how the CIA put drugs into the Black community.
Today on Power to the People, we'll examine how the U.S. brought cocaine into the Black community as part of a larger genocidal war on Black people, as well as to fully destroy the Black Power movement. The United States of America's illegal imperialist regime, it is literally the biggest drug trafficker in the world, and even the CIA itself, it has the nickname of being the Cocaine Intelligence Agency, as the CIA, they literally funnel drugs into the country to destroy revolutionary movements, as well as to destroy Black communities. The United States, it declared an all-out war on the Black Panther Party. The government was willing to do anything and everything to destroy the party, as the government labeled the party as the biggest threat to national security.
The government used the illegal FBI's COINTEL program to assassinate, to launch character assassinations, to lock up, and to torture black revolutionaries who were seeking to put power into the hands of the people, as that is where power belongs. The Central Intelligence Agency, they also had a major role in destroying the Black Panther Party. The United States, with the Cold War, they declared war on socialism, whether it was domestic or international, and they began launching coups and proxy wars to protect the corporate interests of imperialist America. CIA, also known as the Corporate Intelligence Agency, they did everything in its power to destroy socialism. The CIA already had a war on the Black Panther Party, and in 1979, the people of Nicaragua, they had a successful revolution against the U.S.-backed Somoza dictatorship. The CIA, they then launched a war on the Sandinistas, who were a left-wing socialist revolutionary organization that just came into the power. The U.S., through the Central Intelligence Agency, they figured they could use one stone for the same target. The U.S. needed to fund the right-wing Contras to fight against the left-wing Sandinistas. But to fund a CIA proxy war, you need money. The Contras began funneling drugs to the CIA, and then the CIA, they began selling drugs to dealers within different black communities. Not only did this enact violence and terrorism against the people of Nicaragua, but it ultimately led to the defeat of the Sandinista government. And in the black community, crack cocaine, it became an epidemic. Now, if we put the Contra War and the destruction of the Black Panther Party into the proper historical context, we can begin to see the connection. As in 1979, the Contra War started and cocaine began being smuggled into the USA by the CIA. And then what do we, 3 years later? 3 years later, in 1982, the Black Panther Party was dissolved. The CIA literally put the final touches on the tactical defeat of the Black Panther Party by using chemical warfare against the black community. And its effects, it can still be felt today. Some might say, oh, here you go again, Abbas, with the conspiracy theories, you tripping. But literally the CIA itself, the CIA, they admitted to this, claiming that they quote unquote overlooked the Contras drug sales in the US. They also admitted to working with Contras, who were the ones dealing drugs. DEA field agent Hector Burrells, he said, quote, I believe that elements working for the CIA were involved in bringing drugs into the country. Another DEA agent named Celerino Castillo III, he claimed that in the 1980s, the Ilopango Airport in El Salvador, which was used by the Contras to smuggle drugs into the country, he said that, quote, his attempts to investigate the Contra drug smuggling were stymied by the DEA management, the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador, and the CIA. And these facts have literally led to Hollywood making TV shows and movies about it, allowing media corporations to make money and get rich through shows like Snowfall that have dramatized what has happened. Crack in the black community, it has been devastating, and it's led to tens of thousands of deaths. The homicide rate in the black community increased, the fetal death rate increased, and there was an increase in low birth weight babies. And this also led to the war on drugs, even though the U.S. is the ones that put the drugs into the community in the first place. And this war on drugs, it was profitable. It created the conditions for mass incarceration in which black people are the most affected. And then they're subjected to slavery from mass incarceration through the 13th Amendment, allowing corporations to get rich. Now, there's more black men under correctional control than were enslaved. The effects of crack cocaine on the black community has been nothing short of genocidal. The inhumanity of the United States regime, the inhumanity of this regime, is a threat to humanity itself. This is Power to the People. I'm Abbas Luther King.
Now, in many cases, addictions end up ruining marriages, friendships, and careers. Unfortunately, out of the over 20 million Americans with at least one addiction in the United States, only 10% are actually treated and the rest stay on a perilous path, which could potentially end with an overdose. Well, I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and please join us again next week when we return with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وَلَقَدْ يَسَّرْنَا الْقُرْآنَ لِلذِّكْرِ فَهَلْ مِن مُدَّكِرٍ
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 31 and 32 of Surah Najm.
وَلِلَّهِ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ لِيَجْزِيَ الَّذِينَ أَسَاءُوا بِمَا عَمِلُوا وَيَجْزِيَ الَّذِينَ أَحْسَنُوا بِالْحُسْنَى الَّذِينَ يَجْتَنِبُونَ كَبَائِرَ الْإِثْمِ وَالْفَوَاحِشَ إِلَّا اللَّمَمَ إِنَّ رَبَّكَ وَاسِعُ الْمَغْفِرَةِ هو أعلم بكم إذ أنشأكم من الأرض وإذ أنتم أجنة في بطون أمهاتكم فلا تزكوا أنفسكم هو أعلم بمن اتقى.
To Allah belongs whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, that he may punish those who do evil for what they have done, and reward those who do good with the best of rewards. Those who avoid major sins and indecencies, excepting minor and occasional lapses, indeed your Lord is expansive in his forgiveness. He knows best since the time he produced you from the earth and when you were fetuses in the bellies of your mothers. So do not flaunt your piety. He knows best who are God-weary. If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last Friday, we referred to the limited knowledge and perception of those who are unmindful of God Almighty and have exchanged their human dignity and honor with mundane possessions. We also said that conjecture regarding faith and vital matters results in irreparable loss, and the omniscient Lord knows best who have gone astray from the path of truth and who deserve guidance. The ayahs that we recited to you today point to the infinite power of the Almighty Creator, to whom belong whatever exists in the heavens and the earth, and therefore he solely deserves to be worshipped. The main purpose of the creation of the world is to test the obedience of the best of creation, that is, mankind, who, unlike other creatures, has been given the intellect and the power of speech to discern good from evil, in order to be guided toward the path of perfection through existential, legislative, and didactic methods applied by the prophets. Thus, Ayah 31 means to say that those who indulge in disbelief and sins bring punishment upon themselves after having been given respite and shown mercy, while for the virtuous God Almighty has reserved the best of rewards. Ayah 32 says, God Almighty bestows further favors upon those who refrain from committing grave sins, and this abstention from committing grave sins leads to forgiving of lesser sins. But persistence in committing lesser sins turns them into grave sins. Our Creator is best aware of our inner feelings and even thoughts that flash across our minds. He is so merciful that he forgives minor sins because of abstention from committing grave ones, which could also be forgiven through sincere repentance. Towards its end, the ayah cautions the virtuous as well against flaunting their piety or doing of good, since ostentation, pretension, reproach, and the like are negative qualities. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, creation is not without aim. Hence, we are accountable to God for our deeds. Number two, righteous people are also prone to lapses, but the purity of their character makes them repent and seek forgiveness. Number three, never should we consider ourselves to be immune from evil deeds, since vanity and self-conceit leads to error. And number four, the Almighty Creator is aware of every minute thing, even thoughts that flash across our minds. Now let us listen to ayahs 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, and 38 of the same surah.
أَفَرَأَيْتَ الَّذِي تَوَلَّى وَأَعْطَى قَلِيلًا وَأَكْدَى أَعِنْدَهُ عِلْمُ الْغَيْبِ فَهُوَ يَرَى أَمْ لَمْ يُنَبَّأْ بِمَا فِي صُحُفِ مُوسَى وإبراهيم الذي وفى ألا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى.
Did you see him who turned away, gave a little and held off? Does he have the knowledge of the unseen so that he sees? Has he not been informed of what is in the scriptures of Moses and of Abraham, who fulfilled his summons, that no bearer shall bear another's burden? These ayahs stress each and every person's responsibilities in a different way, and are a warning to those who think they can place the burden of their sins on others by giving them something meager in the mortal life of the transient world on the assumption of being relieved of their heavy burden on Judgment Day. Some of them are so niggardly that they're not inclined to help the needy from the wealth that God has given them, and try to shrug off their responsibility for the evil they thus commit. If Ayah 35 puts the rhetoric question whether such a person has knowledge of the unseen, Ayahs 36 and 37 refute these false beliefs by pointing out that even the previously revealed heavenly scriptures, such as the books given to Moses and Abraham, peace upon them, God had clarified that no person may take the responsibility of others, and each and every person stands accountable for his own sins. Prophet Abraham is cited as an example of supreme obedience to God, since he fulfilled such difficult tribulations as being content with divine will, while being thrown by the tyrant Nimrod into the huge fire that miraculously turned into a cool garden for him, and his steadfastness in sacrificing his son Ishmael, as commanded by the Lord Most High, who, at the last moment, substituted a ram for the equally obedient youth. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, we must help the poor and the needy without being niggardly from what God has given us, since whatever we possess is nothing but a trial for us. Number two, Prophet Abraham was the role model of self-sacrifice and fulfillment of duties. Number three, we should be on guard against the deception of those who entice us with sins, saying they would take the responsibility. And number four, every person is responsible for his or her deeds, and no one takes the burden of another's sin. In conclusion of this week's episode, let us listen to Ayahs 39, 40, 41, and 42 of Surah Najm.
وَأَن لَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى وَأَنَّ سَعْيَهُ سَوْفَ يُرَى ثُمَّ يُجْزَاهُ الْجَزَاءَ الْأَوْفَى وَأَنَّ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ الْمُنْتَهَى.
And that nothing belongs to man except what he strives for, and that he will soon be shown his endeavor. Then he will be rewarded for it with the fullest reward, and that the terminus is towards your Lord. It is clear from these ayahs that nothing belongs to us except what we strive for, whether good or bad, which means everyone enjoys the fruits of their efforts. The one who perseveres in the fulfillment of his or her tasks not only will soon receive the reward of his or her righteous good deeds in full, but also will reap further rewards for the same, because of God's mercy. It is mentioned in the Noble Quran that each and every righteous good deed will accrue tenfold rewards, while some God-weary believers will receive rewards several times as much. Ayah 42 means to say that everything shall in duty aptly return to the Almighty Creator, since He is the final cause and the pivot of the world of creation. The world's beginning and its end rests on God's pure essence alone. These ayahs teach us that, number one, our duty is to fulfill our responsibilities without bothering about results. Number two, no deed is perishable, and it is the immortality of deeds and the just system of reward and punishment that encourages believers to do good deeds. Number three, God is aware of our deeds and efforts and grants countless rewards. And number four, the belief that the end is with God makes us strive for good deeds.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Hundreds of Afghan youths and sportsmen rallied against the U.S. in Kabul. The rally is part of massive anti-U.S. sentiments underway in the country over the recent decision by the American president to give some parts of the Afghans' national assets to the victims of the 9/11 attacks. We want all of our money. Biden is a thief. Death to America. These are the slogans that the protesters chanted as they were holding anti-U.S. placards.
These sportsmen call on the U.S. to reverse its decision and free all of their money. They say freezing Afghanistan's assets has harmed all aspects of the Afghan society.
We have gathered here on behalf of all Afghan youths and sportsmen to condemn the U.S. president's decision to give half of our frozen assets to Americans. Of course, this decision is crazy and unjust. The U.S.'s move has affected all Afghans' lives. Our athletes and sportsmen are quitting their sports due to economic difficulties.
The angry protesters also say that if the U.S. does not reverse its unjust and immoral decision, their protests will escalate.
The U.S. considers itself as one of the richest countries, but now it's shamelessly stealing from the poorest people of the world. We call on the U.S. to free all of our frozen assets and stop punishing and torturing Afghans. Our demonstrations will continue until we reach our rights.
Staging in front of the U.N. office in Kabul, the protesters called on the UN and World Bank donors not to stay silent against the U.S. operations and stay by Afghans' side.
Afghans were not involved in 9/11 attack. This is crystal clear to the world countries. So why should the U.S. seek revenge from us? In addition, today Afghans are dealing with many economic and health crises. We urge the international community to make the U.S. reconsider its decision and let the flow of aid to our vulnerable people.
Last week, the U.S. president signed an order allowing half of $7 billion in Afghan frozen assets to be given to 9/11 victims. The move has sparked outrage in Afghanistan and was massively denounced. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is an occasion to honor poets and poetry. The 16th edition of Fan